So I'm gonna try to give a bit of a general overview of Korava gravity and try to then focus on relatively newer results. So that's a general outline. I'm gonna talk about the framework of the theory, what it's about, and then try to present the various versions of the theory so that we can clarify any misconceptions about what everybody means by Horava-Lipschitz gravity. There are different people that mean different things. Then I'm gonna talk about consistency and the infrared viability of the theory, about its properties a little bit and its phenomenology. And I'm gonna try to close with some open questions and how we might wanna address these questions in the future and possible ways to address them, and my conclusions. This is a list of topics that I'm gonna cover, but I'm not gonna cover them necessarily at this order and in such a neat way. So what's the basic idea? The basic idea is that we want to solve the null problem, which is the non-generalizability of Einstein gravity. And we already know that possible solution to this problem would be to add higher curvature invariants. This would modify the propagator, it would render the theory renormalizable. But we already know from the 70s and from the works of Steller that this generically introduces ghosts, ghost degrees of freedom, so it comes at a very high cost. We make a theory, we can create a renormalizable theory of gravity, but it's not unitary anymore. So one could think along the following lines. Simple solution is forget about Lorentz symmetry. I just keep the time derivatives to two, as usual. I just add higher order spatial derivatives. This way, I don't generate extra degrees of freedom. So I don't have to, at least naively thinking, I don't have to worry about ghosts and all that. But I can still modify the propagator, and potentially I could still make the theory normalizable. And that's a general, a very general, let's say, idea behind Horava gravity. But of course, it's not that simple. First of all, you're giving up a fundamental symmetry, or at least what seems to be a fundamental symmetry, Lorentz symmetry. And secondly, it's not that easy to count the degrees of freedom when you start giving up, adding extra derivatives. But we'll see that in more. Well, it's not a physical argument. It's just a motivation that you think, if you think you can make you can create a renormalizable gravity theory out of that, and if you can potentially keep the violations of the symmetry low enough to not have been detected yet, it would be a good payoff. So you just say, okay, Lorentz symmetry is not an exact symmetry, it's an approximate symmetry, and I managed to renormalize my, to have a normalizable gravity theory. So that's like a, that's the trade-off. Okay? So the general principle of why you could create a renormalizable model in this way is probably best exhibited by a simple scalar field, which is much less complicated than gravity. So take an action for the scalar field. You have the standard kinetic term. Then you have here some power of the Laplace operator and some interactions for the scalar field. You can view this as summed indices if you want. You choose some scaling dimensions, do some power counting, and see how things work in the UV. So suppose that kappa is some placeholder with dimensions of momenta, and you choose the scaling dimension this way. So there is some anisotropic scaling, and there's this index here, z, that is related to this anisotropic scaling. And you go into your power counting, and you see how things scale here. So you see what are the dimensions of the field phi and the various couplings. And now, notice the following, that if I choose z to be equal to m here, then these couplings become dimensionless, essentially. And if z is equal to d, the field becomes dimensionless. And then you go and look at these couplings here. This part vanishes, which depends on essentially the power sitting on the interaction. And this is always positive. So essentially, all of the couplings that you see here have positive momentum dimensions. And this is a typical characteristic that, that this is what we're looking for to call a theory power counting renormalizable. So the deal here is if the higher operator that appears here that will dominate in the UV essentially, comes at power m, I can, it seems natural to choose scaling dimensions where m equals z. And then, if I've chosen, and then in a suitable number of dimensions, the theory will always be renormalizable. Or starting from the dimension, suppose I'm working on a given number of dimensions, add as much derivatives, as many spatial derivatives as twice the spatial dimension, essentially. And then there is a natural way to do the power counting, that you will see that all couplings have positive momentum dimensions, and that's an renormalizable theory. This is the way it works. And of course, it would work perfectly well also if Z was larger than D. Okay? So that's the general principle under which we want to work on, but we want to apply this to gravity. So things get a little bit more complicated. How do you add more spatial derivatives than time derivatives? Well, you have to do an ADM splitting, essentially. You have to tell me what is time and what is space. So suppose that you introduce a standard ADM splitting with a lapse, a shift, and a three metric. And you take this time seriously, essentially. Then to do that, you have to break part of diffeomorphism invariance, right? You don't, if you want to take your time seriously, you're not allowed to mix it with space anymore. So you'll have some, but you can still do the rest. So you could have like time reparametrizations and space, space-time dependent three diffeomorphisms, but you're not allowed to essentially mix time with space. And then you try to construct an action out of that. And generically, the action will look like this. So here, I have the extrinsic curvature, which essentially has the time derivatives of the three metric, which is the analog to the scalar field I was showing before, because we know that these are the terms that respect the symmetry by construction, essentially, and they contain time derivatives. Here, you see that you get an arbitrary coupling lambda instead of just one that you would get in general relativity, and this is because you don't have full diffeo invariance to fix that to one for you. So a new coupling pops out. And then there, here are the possible terms you could write that have spatial derivatives. So the time derivatives, just by the requirement that I want second order equations in time, fix the action to be that with this symmetry. And then I have this thing here, and in theory I should include in there everything that is allowed by the symmetry. If I don't, it will anyway come back and find me through loop loop corrections. So this is how I should proceed to construct the general theory. So let me focus now a little bit on this potential. So the general fraction of the potential is this one. These two terms come at lower order. So they're like second order operators, essentially. I could also add the cosmological constant freely, which I haven't included here. And then I would have higher order terms. And what kind of higher order terms I need? Well, I'm in three spatial dimensions. So I need twice as many derivatives. I need two times three, six derivatives in the action to achieve this the renormalizability properties that I demonstrate with the scalar. So I need to have up to sixth order derivatives. So I'll have some fourth order operators, some sixth order operators that will be suppressed by some suitable scale, which will be related to Lorentz violations, essentially. You will get Lorentz violations appearing at this scale in terms of modified dispersion relations. And there is a good number of these operators, as I'll say shortly. Let me first point out that already from this potential and the kinetic term I showed you before, you realize that there are essentially two types of Lorentz violations coming in. There are those that come already at the lowest order, right? So this term here that you see, which is essentially the derivatives of the lapse, is already a Lorentz violating term. It's not there in general relativity. And the same goes for this lambda here. If lambda is different than one, this also signals Lorentz violations at the lowest order. So you have Lorentz violating terms that persist even in the IR sector of the theory. But, and then you have terms in here, which are more relevant for the UV, with a characteristic Lorentz violating scale, essentially suppressing them, which will manifest as modifications to the dispersion relation, so as nonlinearities in the dispersion relation. Additionally, one characteristic of the theory that we will discuss about in detail later on, is that it will propagate one extra scalar degree of freedom. And how can you see that? Well, you can see that because the theory has less symmetry. So it has less symmetry. It doesn't have full Diffeo invariance. It has less symmetry than general relativity. So you could actually have guessed that it will have extra degrees of freedom. Just because you didn't add any extra time derivatives doesn't mean that you don't get extra degrees of freedom. And we're going to see this degree of freedom later on. Finally, what about these operators here? Well, that's a bit of a problem because, of course, you can find them and write them down, but they're order 10 to the 2. So as you saw, the lower order operators, the extra operators with respect to GR are just 2, so just a nice IR modification, let's say. I mean, well-defined, you know what you're doing. But at the fourth order, you get about 10, and here you get about 60. So you get too many free couplings. In principle, the theory is well-defined. I know what I'm doing. I have these couplings. I can fix it by experiment, but I need a whole lot of experiments to actually fix all of them, right? So that's kind of an issue. And it's more of an issue for the UV part of the theory than the IR, because the IR, because the couplings proliferate as you go higher and higher. So from the point of view of consistency and viability, the full theory that I've wrote down is actually fully consistent and viable for a non-zero part of the low-order coupling parameter space, as I'll explain before. But it does have clearly this unappealing characteristic of having too many couplings. Now, what can you do to reduce the couplings? That, of course, this came up immediately already by Petter's initial paper. So, sorry?
The scalar degree of freedom, but it also have the Lipschitz symmetry or not?
You mean that for an anisotropic scaling? If it has an, yes, it does. In this version, it does, because there are operators essentially at the sixth order that will give a contribution to its propagator essentially. So even this one, but I'll discuss this later if you give me some time. I'll come to this matter. So how do you limit the number of couplings and make the theory more appealing? So Petter in his initial paper wanted to use two restrictions, let's say, that could limit the number of couplings. The first one was projectability. So the restriction that the lapse is only a function of time. As a generic restriction before even doing anything, at the level of the action, essentially, you're saying that n is just a function of time. And how does that limit the number of terms? Well, first of all, there are no terms that invariants that you can construct with a partial derivative of the lapse. Remember, before I defined this vector, which was essentially the derivative of the logarithm of the lapse. And this is a three vector, so there's a bunch of invariants that they can construct with this and with contracting it with curvature invariants. So I lose a lot of terms with this assumption. The other thing is that it's a bit more subtle, is that n is sitting in the four volume, right? If you make it a function of time only, then every spatial derivative, you can throw it in spatial derivatives and it's much easier to create surface terms. So some terms would be related to each other by a total divergence and you'll lose even more terms. So that's a powerful restriction, essentially, when it comes to limiting the number of couplings. The other restriction was detailed balance, what he called detailed balance, which is like, the name is inspired by condensed matter physics and critical phenomena and all that. But it essentially amounts to saying, okay, I construct the potential in the following way. I have some three-dimensional action, essentially. And I create this tensor by varying this action. Then I contract it twice with this quantity here, which is, as you can, maybe you can recognize that it's some sort of generalization of the DeWitt metric. And I create the potential. This metric I read off essentially from the kinetic term. The kinetic term also has a structure, extrinsic curvature contracted with this thing. So I do the same for the potential term. Is there any physical reason why I should do that in this theory, apart from simplifying my action? The answer is probably no, or at least we don't know of any. I mean, we know that there are, as I said, systems in condensed matter that have this property, but there is no reason why this should be true here. So at this stage, I would just say that unless we have any further evidence we should be doing that, I don't see any reason why we should. But it does significantly limit the number of operators. So you go, so the action initially considered by Peter was this one, which essentially goes from, you know, order 100 couplings to 5 or so. So this is the full theory. But already by just looking at this action, you see that it has some unappealing characteristics. And so there is only, what's a good thing is that there is only one sixth order term here. So only one term that will be important in the UV. But first of all, to have this term, it is necessary to also and have the standard Einstein term. It is necessary to have parity violating terms like this one here. You see, that's a fifth order operator here. And why is that? Well, by looking at the action, you can say that the coupling of this term, dimensionless coupling here is A. Then what sits in front of the standard Ricci scalar is this beta. And here you just have A squared and beta. So this fifth order term is not really, doesn't have an independent coupling on its own. If you have this one and that one, you'll definitely have this one. And this is very simple. This is because you've asked this detailed balance. You said that the potential should be a quadratic form in this EIJ, right? So to create a sixth order term, you needed to have a sixth order term in here, you need a third order term in here. So if you have a third order term, and it will also contract with lower order terms, and it will give you a fifth order term as well, right? By the way, this third order term is the gravitational Chern-Simon term, essentially, the invariant you can build a third order. So one thing is that in order to have this action and have the sixth order operator that you need for renormalizability, you also need to have fifth order operators. Another issue, you cannot impose, essentially, parity invariants. If you impose parity invariants, you lose all of them. Another thing is what you mentioned, that in this case, the scalar field doesn't have proper lifted scaling at high energies. It doesn't have any sixth order derivatives. And the reason is this term here is the square of the Cotton tensor. This Cij is the Cotton tensor. So what's the Cotton tensor? Well, it's a traceless tensor, essentially, that is, roughly speaking, the analog of the Weyl tensor in three dimensions. So in three dimensions, the Weyl tensor is identically zero. And if a three-dimensional space is conformally flat, then the Cotton tensor is zero as well. So you can understand then why essentially this doesn't contribute anything to the scalar mode, to the scalar mode, which roughly speaking a conformal factor in the metric. So you don't get any contribution from the sixth order term in the scalar mode. So the scalar mode satisfies a fourth order dispersion relation and therefore doesn't have the Lipschitz behavior that we want. So this compromises renormalizability. Finally, there is this cosmological constant sitting here, right? Which you cannot avoid because it also doesn't have, it's also not an independent coupling, right? Everything depends. So this is the coupling to matter, essentially. And these are the couplings that are sitting in front of other terms. So it's completely fixed. Both its value and its sign is completely fixed by other things. So once you assume, once you require that the graviton is not a ghost, the spin to graviton is not a ghost, then this has a definite sign. It has to be negative. And if you notice then that for decent phenomenology, you want these to be order one quantities, you realize that that's a huge, not necessarily order one, but relatively, but not very small quantities, then this becomes a very large scale. So it has a cosmological constant which is large and negative, as opposed to small and positive. You could actually ask me what I mean by large, so I'll tell you what I mean by large. I mean that there will be no regime in this action where this term will dominate over both that one and that one, okay? Either you will have to include the higher order corrections, or you will have to consider take seriously the cosmological constant. So there's like no, you can never define a flat path essentially anywhere and do physics with that. Okay, so these are, I'm only talking about things, about shortcomings, let's say, that you could readily see just by looking at the action, right, without doing analysis, because there are other things that we'll talk about later. So what if you give up detail balance? I told you, I mean, okay, there's nothing sacred about it. Let's throw it in the dustbin and see what we can do without that. How already projectability actually reduces a lot the number of couplings. So this is the most general action with projectability, the lapse being just a function of time, but without any other assumption. And it has 10 as opposed to 4 independent couplings, still much better than 100. I mean, still the same order of magnitude, let's say. And this way, I mean, you can impose parity invariance, you can kill all parity violating operators. You can have an arbitrary cosmological constant because it depends on it becomes an independent coupling, sitting here. And you get the right UV behavior for the scalar because you have sixth order operators that will contribute to the scalar mode. So this version seems, at least at face value, to be much better than the one with just detailed balance. And without, you know, paying such a high price in adding more operators. So that's a so-called projectable version of the theory. Instead of 4 couplings, I have 10 now. So the whole thing was how to reduce the number of couplings. Right? Now, on the other hand, you could also play the opposite game and say, what if I give away projectability and keep detail balance? And you'll see very soon, later on, why there are obvious reasons why you would want to give up projectability. But these are not obvious at the level of the action, right? And then what you get is, so this requires a little bit of thinking because you're saying, okay, once I do that, first of all, at the lowest order in the action, or the second order, I really get the most general action I could get with the only restriction of the cosmological constant, of the fact that the cosmological constant is not an independent coupling. So a theory with detailed balance but without projectability at the level of the second order operators is exactly the same as the most general theory I could write down, modulo a large and negative cosmological constant. Okay? That's the only restriction. The other problem, however, that I have to solve is the renormalizability of the scalar graviton, the sixth order operators of the scalar graviton, right? Well, how can I work with that? I could say, hold on, what happens if I go to this W, this lower dimensional action, which was producing for me the potential, and I include fourth order operators. Then I'll have eighth order operators in the action. If everything works well, the action will still be renormalizable because I needed at least sixth order operators. I didn't need to stay there. How many couplings can I get? Because detailed balance is pretty restrictive in what terms can I have. So I can actually do that, and I'll just get 12 couplings. So I'm still order 10. I could still create a theory with order 10 couplings, which has operators of the sixth and eighth order. It seems perfectly normalizable for all the mode it has. But the only real problem that it seemed to have at the moment is the very large and negative cosmological constant. Well, if you want to be very optimistic, you can entertain ideas about about the self-tuning and say, okay, well, if I get a large and negative cosmological constant for free, that's a bare cosmological constant. Could there be that once I add the vacuum energy, something good happens for me? But okay, that's just wishful thinking. I mean, at the moment, I wouldn't know of any mechanism to get rid of this cosmological constant in this way. Exactly. That is a point that essentially you have to somehow address the problem of the overall vacuum energy plus cosmological constant, right? Practically having a large and negative cosmological constant is no better than not knowing at all and having to fine tune it to be small. It's the same level of fine tuning. The difference, of course, with GR is here we cannot put this problem under the carpet because if you're hoping that this is a quantum gravity, a realistic quantum gravity theory, it should address this problem eventually. You have to consider the coupling to matter, see how things work, and see what you actually get for vacuum energy. So eventually we'll have to address this problem. You cannot just say, okay, that's an effective theory. you know, quantum gravity plus plus quantum field theory will answer eventually this problem for us, and we don't have to worry. We do have to worry about it somehow. Okay, so that's this version of the theory. So essentially, what you see already is that there are various, there are little differences at the IR level. And then there is a big discussion about how many operators you should be including in the, in the UV. But the main phenomenology of the UV of these theories are essentially the same, because it's not very, very sensitive to the various couplings. It's more sensitive to if you include the right order of the couplings. Now, let me talk a little bit about the scalar mode, which is the major issue when it comes to the consistency and the viability of this theory. So take the most general theory without any restriction at the lowest order. This is the action. You do scalar perturbations, essentially, to just see how the scalar mode behaves around flat space. And you get this action at the quadratic level in perturbations. And then you can readily read off that if you want to have positive energy and no instabilities, then lambda should be sitting, should be higher than one or lower than one third, and eta should be between 2 xi and 0. So outside this interval, the scalar is either a ghost or it's unstable, classically unstable, right? But this is a fine interval, okay? In theory, what you're saying, gr, by the way, is sitting at lambda equals 1 and eta equals 0, right? So you're saying, okay, if I'm coming, let's say, for instance, these are running couplings, so I'm going to run from somewhere to there. So suppose that I'm running from lambda higher than 1 close to gr, essentially, and I want to recover gr to some extent, so as to satisfy the constraints and all that, then it seems perfectly fine. I can just run from eta slightly larger than 0 and lambda slightly larger than 1 to these values, and everything would be fine. However, so this is for the general theory. It would also apply to the version with detailed balance without projectability if you had some way to address the cosmological constant problem, because that's the same theory. But what happens to the theory with projectability? As soon as you add projectability, gesture. No. I should have said that. Yeah. So part of the deal is that detailed balance is not a real symmetry, right? So it is not a real symmetry. So I don't see any reason why it should be preserved by the normalization group flow. It will probably be spoiled. So the question is, to which extent will it be spoiled? I mean, in theory, you could even be hopeful and say, okay, could I have some sort of soft violation that will just come and do away with a cosmological constant without spoiling things too much? But again, this is at the level of wishful thinking. Theoretically, you could say it's not preserved. I don't see why it should be preserved, so I shouldn't be using it. On the other hand, I mean, if you want to really pose this question rigorously and do a calculation, you want to know that you have a model which has detailed balance and it's a workable model, right? And this was the reason why we even consider it. So the initial model by Peter had detailed balance and projectability, was dead on arrival because it had serious other problems. So the question was, could you implement the detailed balance, still have a healthy theory, and then it's worth asking this question, whether it will be preserved or what will the normalization group flow do? And this is something that needs to be checked, essentially, at this stage. So what happens now if I have projectability? Well, projectability is the limit where eta goes to infinity, because then this AI term has to be by itself zero, essentially, which imposes that the lab should be space independent. So if I take the action that I had before and I just take eta to infinity, I get this thing here. So now things change a little bit, because what you have is the mode is unstable whenever lambda is bigger than 1 or less than 1/3, and a ghost whenever it's in between these modes. So really, you stand no chance. I mean, unless you're sitting at lambda equals 1, then which is the GR value, let's say, then you don't seem to have any way to do anything. There are some claims that if you would actually add, you know, a cosmological constant and try to do the analysis around the sitter, the behavior of the mode would be better. But I think this is not very relevant to this discussion. I mean, in general, if you put unstable stuff in the sitter space and the space is expanding fast enough, they seem more stable. But the question is, what is locally the behavior of the mode? Is it growing locally or not? So in any realistic situation, the cosmological constant would be small enough so that local physics should make sense on its own. So this is typical gradient instability, essentially. So classically unstable, the mode has like growing, it's growing, exponentially growing.
This is the sound speed too little, too small?
The sound speed is negative.
But the sitter doesn't cure that because...
No, the sitter doesn't cure that. The point is that the sitter doesn't cure that, but once you put things that grow in space that grows faster, and then you look at the relative growth, they don't grow that fast anymore. It will only cure the very long wavelengths, of course. And the idea is that for the short wavelengths, the higher order operators will come and cure that.
Exactly,
in order to actually achieve that for all wavelengths, you essentially need to have a situation where you can never define a flat patch where things behave normally. This is what I meant before when I said you need to have a flat patch and there things have to work. So where was I? But apart from this, you can also go and see something else. Okay, this is like, I showed you the quadratic action in perturbations. What if I go in one order higher in perturbations? Well, essentially, I will see that at some point, the low energy part of the theory, the IR sector of the theory, will get strongly coupled. This is the same that we get in GR. There is, at some point, the theory gets strongly coupled. And what is this scale? So you can go and find this scale, and it's essentially this. It's lambda minus 1 to the 3 halves times the Planck scale. Which means the closer you go to GR, the closer to go to lambda equals 1, the lower this scale becomes. So, and if you try to approach lambda equals 1, which is the only allowed value, essentially, that you are either a ghost or unstable, then the theory gets strongly coupled at all scales, right? So that seems to be an acceptably, at face value, you could say, okay, this is an unacceptably low energy to get strong coupling, because we know that gravity works perturbatively at some energies. But somebody could tell you exactly the opposite. You could argue in exactly the opposite way. You could argue, you just showed me a perturbative action. You told me that the scalar mode does not behave well. But then you also showed me that the perturbative regime is not good enough. So maybe there are no pathologies. Maybe non-perturbatively everything works, right? Maybe there is an IR fixed point, and which is lambda equals 1 and eta equals 0, which is GR, and the theory just runs very quickly to this fixed point, and I'm done. And it's essentially Sinsi Mukohyam and his collaborators that are putting forth this interpretation. They're trying to figure out if this is indeed the case. The obvious current argument to that is the following. I also argued renormalizability perturbatively. I mean, I argue that the perturbative level, that the theory is perturbatively normalizable. If you're hoping that, okay, there is the IR fixed point, and that in general I cannot trust perturbation theory, then you should not sell me the arguments about the normalizability at the perturbative level. And if the theory is to be non-perturbatively normalizable, then maybe even GR is. I'm not actually sure, because nobody knows if GR is non-perturbatively normalizable, if it has a non-trivial UV fixed point. So. You're losing part of the motivation, essentially, if you want to argue this way. So, again, I don't want to be too negative on that, because in theory, it is really that gets a bit technical, but it's actually really the momentum constraint that needs to be treated non-perturbatively, and there's a good chance that if you treat that non-perturbatively, the rest of the theory remains perturbative, and therefore maybe you can argue. But it gets very, the thing in it actually gets messy. You really have to go into the fine details of the theory and see if this theory can make non-perturbative predictions, if it's renormalizable and all that. So it definitely is, let's say, the least obvious way to go than the theory without projectability. What about now strong coupling in if I don't have projectability. So I have a theory which had a healthy growing, a healthy scalar mode and all that, but do I get strong coupling there? Of course I get strong coupling in the IR action. I mean, this is for granted. And I do get strong coupling at some energy scale, which is essentially given by the Planck scale times some function of lambda minus one and eta, the two Lorentz violating couplings, right? And what this function is, it depends essentially because various terms get strongly coupled, and you have to. I get strongly coupled above the scale, so that is the strong coupling scale essentially. So I can treat energies up to that, and then so in theory that can be a relatively large scale. It doesn't have to be as low, because I don't have to be as low. I have to tune these couplings to satisfy some observations. Essentially, they have to be small, but the scale doesn't have to be very small. I'll discuss later on what I mean in numbers, but. Even if this scale is large enough to not have anything to do with the IR phenomenology of the theory, it is still a threat of renormalizability for the reason I said before. I don't want the theory to get strongly coupled because I've argued everything at the perturbative level. I want to be able to trust perturbation theory at all energies. And so what about this strong coupling? So this essentially forces me to assume that whatever this strong coupling scale is, it should be larger than the scale that the higher order operators come into the game. So that the IR part gets strongly coupled, but that would happen at energies higher than the next order operators come in. And this imposes an upper bound on the Lorentz breaking scale. And that's an important thing, actually, because usually observations impose a lower bound on this scale. So this way you bin the scale. You say the Lorentz violating scale, it cannot be too high, it cannot be too low. And I put it in between a rock and a hard place, and then I see how big this bin is. So let's talk about this a little bit. So essentially, of course, recovering Lorentz symmetry by some sort of running of the renormalization group is kind of out of the question, because if you recover Lorentz symmetry, lambda will. If you would accidentally recover Lorentz symmetry in the IR because the renormalization group flow will take you there, then lambda would be one, eta would be zero, and the strong coupling scale would become zero, essentially. The theory would be strongly coupled at all energies. So this is kind of out of the question here. You need to entertain the idea of small Lorentz violations, essentially. And then the question is how small? So one way, so this second order operators that are Lorentz violating, which are related to lambda and eta, these two couplings, right, are purely in the gravity side. So they will be constrained by Lorentz violations in gravitational experiments. And these are essentially preferred frame effects. So what people have done is they coupled the theory minimally to matter, essentially. And then they said, okay, let's do the PPN expansion. The constraints in the PPN expansion, the only PPN parameters that differ from standard general relativity are the preferred frame parameters. They are measured with accuracy of 10 to the minus 7, essentially, the most accurate of those. So roughly speaking, I need these things to be of order 10 to the minus 7 or smaller. Then I can go and calculate, put it back in the calculation about the strong coupling scale, and I can find what this upper bound for the strong coupling scale, as I just told you. And it turns out to be about 10 to the 16 GeV. So essentially, if I want my theory to make sense perturbatively at all energies, then the Lorentz violating scale should be sitting below 10 to the 16 GeV. Then let me assume now that this is a universal scale, right? At all sectors of my theory, both gravity and matter, I'm going to see Lorentz violations kicking in at this scale M star. If I make this assumption, then I can go and look at observations for Lorentz violations coming from the matter sector and see what they tell me about this, right? And in general, I would say that you can safely assume that this has to be sitting higher than 10 to the 10 GeV. So they're like a six order of magnitude window here. if you use the most conservative constraints on Lorentz violations in the matter sector. But there are also constraints that are coming from high energy cosmic rays. And actually, these are super Planckian constraints. So if you take this constraint seriously, then there is no window. You've actually already closed the window for this thing. Why should you should not take the constraint seriously? Well, essentially, these constraints come from what is called the GZK cutoff. So you have the spectrum of high energy cosmic rays, and there is a sharp cutoff over some energy. And the physics related to the cutoff is not very well understood. So assuming that the people that do the constraints know what they're doing and taking for granted that the physics is the one we think it is, then you can impose super Planckian constraints. But it might be that there is nothing, that you do have Lorentz violations, the physics there is a bit fuzzy, and therefore these are not like so robust constraints, the ones coming from the cosmic rays. So in any case, I mean, this is a very optimistic thing because you're under the assumption that the scale is universal, that it also is the same scale that you see Lorentz violation in matter, this window will soon close if it's not closed already because these constraints will eventually improve, okay? But, so does that rule out the theory? Well, before going into this, let me ask, okay, isn't there percolation of the Lorentz violations in the matter sector from the higher order operators to the lower order operators? I assume that I have a higher order operator that is Lorentz violating. I have two scalar fields, they travel at different speeds. Just because of that, won't I have different running of their speeds with the normalization group or different running of the difference between the two speeds with the normalization group? And essentially, yes, this is the case. I mean, these guys here tried to calculate it. Okay, they did it with toy theories, like higher order models, because it was easier to do the loops. But they found that in general, there is a logarithmic running in the difference of velocities of different fields. So you do get the percolation, and you wouldn't be able to avoid the constraints of on the speed of light of various fields, on the speed of various fields, essentially. So you could say, actually, already from this, if there is a universal scale, I have a problem. But there are possible ways out of this. Coming from people associated to the PI, one way or another, one of them is in the room. So there is, you could have actually some extra symmetry that restricts the number of operators you can have in the matter, and somehow, without having imposing Lorentz symmetry, you would not be able to have lower order Lorentz violating operators. And actually, has been proposed that supersymmetry could do this work for you. A less, in my opinion, complicated solution for this problem is if you do something else. Assume that initially the matter is not Lorentz violating. So I take a non-Lorentz violating sector, I couple it to a Lorentz violating sector, but they're coupled essentially through a dimensional coupling like the Planck scale here. And then you go and calculate loops and see how Lorentz violating terms will be generated in the non-Lorentz violating matter sector, practically, through this coupling. And then it turns out that the ratio of the Lorentz violating scale in the gravity sector and the Planck mass will form essentially a dimensionless constant that will come and suppress this Lorentz violating terms in the matter. And so if you have a wide separation of these scales, if the Lorentz violating scale is much smaller than the Planck scale, then you have a very small number coming there, suppressing these violations in the matter. And therefore, you're not going to see large violations in the matter. Or posed in a different way, and Youngman can correct me if I'm not saying it right, essentially, it seems that it is technically natural to not have the same scale for Lorentz violation in the matter sector and in the gravity sector, to have essentially Lorentz violation coming at relatively low energies in the gravity sector and very, very high energy Lorentz violations in the matter sector, okay? So in this sense, you can avoid all these problems, practically, because gravity itself, if I come back to this slide here, if here I only had to put constraints that are coming from gravity, I would be talking about milli EV, essentially. So there is this huge range of scales that for which I can do that. Okay, so a little bit of contact with a theory that we had studied much before the Horava gravity came into the game. And this is, let's say, a prototype for a Lorentz violating theory that people have studied in the literature. It's Einstein ether theory, which is general relativity coupled to a vector field. That's the most general action you can write with second order in derivatives for the vector, provided that the vector satisfies this constraint. It's unit and time-like. And this is a theory that has been tested. It's viable for a wide range in the parameter space spanned by C1, C2, C3, and C4. And what is its relation with Einstein ether theory? So assume that the ether is hypersurface orthogonal. Okay? Suppose that you impose this assumption at the level of the action before you do anything. Then, locally, this amounts to having a scalar and the ether being given by the scalar through a formula like this, which takes into account that the ether is unit-like. This is why you fix the normalization of the ether. And then say, hold on, this is always a time-like vector. So since this is always a time-like vector, it's actually perfectly sane to go and give up part of my gate symmetry and choose this to be my time coordinate. And if I do this, I essentially get that UA is just the lapse times a Kronecker delta. And I go plug it in the ether equation, and I get this nice action here, which is exactly the low energy action of the non-projectable Horava gravity with this correspondence of couplings. Right? So Einstein ether theory with the extra assumption of hypersurface orthogonality of the ether is essentially the low energy limit of Horava gravity. Now, what do I learn by this? Well, you can learn some things about the low energy phenomenology, but there is also a nice conceptual exercise you can do in your mind to understand something about tuning, what actually constitutes fine tuning, which I think is worth mentioning. So this is an equivalence that is restricted at the low energy that I showed you, right? I didn't include the higher order operators. And of course, there are no higher order operators in Einstein ether theory. But invert this procedure, it gives you essentially a dictionary to say about what to do to covariantize, to write Horava gravity in a covariant form, which is nothing different than the Stueckelberg trick, practically. It's like a different manifestation of the Stueckelberg trick in field theory. So you can start with this would be an order by order equivalent. So you could say, okay, let me now take Horava gravity, focus on the lower order action, introduce essentially explicitly this extra scalar field, which to recover essentially default invariance, this scalar field now, which will be explicit, will be the scalar mode that we found, right? And then use this dictionary to write the higher order terms in a fully covariant way. And I will have covariantized naively the theory. How will this theory be different than taking Einstein ether theory and adding all the fourth order operators and all the sixth order operators? Well, if you take Einstein ether theory, you add all the fourth order operators, you have fourth order time derivatives. And sixth order time derivatives with sixth order operators. So you see that the difference is that there's going to be some tuning in the, if you, the covariantized version of Horava gravity will have some tuning between the couplings of the various terms, will be exactly such that the time derivative, the higher order time derivative cancel out, right? And why is that interesting? Why do I find it interesting? I find it interesting simply because if I would have given you, if you didn't know anything about Horava gravity and I would have given you the theory, you would tell me, why are you even considering this theory? I mean, it's finely tuned and it's not protected by any symmetry. Only if you would put yourself in this preferred foliation, you realize that there is the remaining symmetry, the foliation preserving diffeomorphisms, that seems to protect the action, and therefore it's not really fine-tuned. So this is just, I find it's just an interesting lesson to say, if you're trying to do a bottom-up approach to a quantum gravity theory, you might actually not be getting your symmetries right, and you might not be realizing what is exactly fine tuning. Okay, so some questions now that remain largely unanswered and we would like to answer is, so there was some region of the parameter space, at least for the IR couplings, where the theory made, even the sensible version of the theory was viable, right? How do I know that that the renormalization group will keep me there? How do I know that I'm going to go to these values? So this is something that we haven't studied. These are all running couplings. We don't know how they run with the renormalization group flow. We'd like to find out, but when we have so many terms, it's not that easy to do the calculations, right? Also, we're talking about a theory that is renormalizable. We haven't quantized it. We're just talking about the classical phenomenology, essentially, and consistency of this theory. And, I mean, it's a sensible thing to do. I give you a theory. I tell you this is a candidate for quantum gravity, but I've given you the action. You know what it is. It's fully described. It's much easier to see if it's sensible and viable before going on to quantize it than the other way around. So it's sensible that people did this thing first, I think. But it's about time that we actually start thinking about the other things. Another interesting question has to do with the causal structure of this theory. Here you have, you essentially have a preferred foliation. You have a very rigid causal structure. Do we actually understand this causal structure and what it means, essentially? And this is also relevant to black holes, right? I mean, black holes are the typical solutions where the causal structure is strange in GR. You get horizons and all that. What actually happens in this theory? Then what about singularities? It's supposed to be a renormalizable theory. I don't expect to see any singularities. So at least once I quantize it, I should be able to do away with all this stuff. Finally, the only point in this talk I made any reference to matter was about the PPN expansion. And all I did was assume essentially that couples minimally to gravity. Otherwise, I'd have equivalence principle violations and all that, which are pretty constraining. But we really don't actually understand much about the matter coupling and the relevant phenomenology, right? We only started to understand even how the Lorentz violations will percolate and all that. So that's an interesting issue. And lastly, there is the vacuum energy problem, which, as I said, is a pertinent problem if you want to sell your theory as a quantum gravity model. We have to know, to understand what is going on. So in the last 2 minutes, I'll just show you a couple of slides about some possible ways to start addressing these problems, or actually some of these problems, not all of them. So together with Matt Wissen and Silke Weinfurter, we put together this lower dimensional Horava gravity. So we looked at first at 1+1 dimensions, see if we can find something interesting there. But we didn't find anything interesting because the theory has really no dynamics, actually. It's purely topological. And it's actually also completely identical to 1+1 Einstein ether theory. This is simply because in one special dimension, the exponent is Z, the scaling exponent is just one. So it's Lorentz, it's a Lorentz symmetric theory, essentially. And in one plus one dimension, essentially, all vectors are hypersurface orthogonal. So there is no difference between Einstein ether theory and Horava gravity. But there is not much to be said there. In 2+1 dimensions, however, what we found is there are no spin 2 degrees of propagating degrees of freedom, but there is a scalar graviton and has exactly the same qualitative behavior as in the 3+1 case. It has lifts its scaling. It has roughly the same, it has the same propagator, essentially, modulo the difference in the higher order behavior, and so on. So it does make an interesting candidate to discuss various things. And it's a theory that if you write it in its full glory, it's just this one. It actually has like less than 10 couplings. So maybe it's manageable. Maybe you can say something about, I don't know, renormalization group, quantization, or whatever, in a much simpler fashion. Then the last part, and the people that saw this part of the talk in Guelph will forgive me, is about black holes and the causal structure of these theories. So will there be any black holes in these Lorentz violating theories? I mean, you start thinking about it and you realize, hold on, I have modified dispersion relations, right? If I look at the lower order theory, they're linear dispersion relations. All modes have linear dispersion relations, but they travel at different velocities. So that just by physical definitions tell me I will probably have horizons, but they're not going to be sitting at the same plate. Its mode will have its own horizon practically. Then you realize, yeah, but if I go and include the higher order operators, I don't even have linear dispersion relations anymore. So if I go to arbitrarily high momenta, they will travel at arbitrarily high velocities, high speeds practically. So they can penetrate any horizon. So whatever horizon you can have in a Lorentz violating theory, it will be a low energy artifact. It will be a horizon only for the low energy modes, not for the high energy modes. And so does it make sense to look for black holes? Well, to address this, what we did is that we said, okay, forget about the high energy modes for the moment. Focus on the low energy limit of the theory. Try to find what there would be black holes in this low energy limit of the theory with these multiple horizons. And then we can discuss how are these modified when you add the higher order corrections to the dispersion relations. And I'm going to spare you all the details, but we did that numerically and consider spherically symmetric, static, asymptotically flat black holes with regular horizons, so that they're always regular, all the space-time is regular for these black holes. And the bottom line is that the exterior of these black holes, if you're sitting at a viable part of the parameter space, is not much different than GR. But here I want to focus on the interior. And what happens in the interior? So you integrate, eventually you're going to hit the singularity at the center, of course. There's a curvature singularity hitting at the center. But what I'm plotting here is essentially the boost angle between the ether field. Remember, I mean, that this is the lower order version of the theory. I didn't say that, but spherically symmetric vectors are always hypersurface orthogonal, right? So when you consider spherically symmetric solutions, there will be solutions to both Horava gravity and Einstein ether theory. So essentially, this is like the ether field or the gradient of the scalar, if you want, in Horava gravity. It is essentially the angle, the boost angle is the angle between this field and the normal to the constant R hypersurfaces. So I have the ether look sitting here, I have the constant, the normal to the constant R hypersurface sitting here, and I'm trying to see what is the angle between them, all right? And you see that you come inside, you integrate inside the horizon, and soon after that, at some point, the angle hits zero. And this is a generic behavior. Then you get some oscillations, and you can get different behavior in these oscillations. It can be a damped oscillation, it can be an overdamped oscillation. It can be almost constant amplitude oscillation, but that is not really what I want to focus on. What I want to focus on is eventually the ether comes and aligns with a normal to the constant R hypersurfaces. And why am I so persistent about this? Well, this is because this is a theory with a preferred time. The ether is, per definition, normal to the constant time hypersurfaces, where time is the time. It is the preferred time, exactly because I have these Lorentz violations. So if the moment the ether goes and aligns with the constant R hypersurfaces, it means that constant T and constant R hypersurface coincide. They fall on each other. Right? And this is a preferred time. I cannot say, okay, let me exchange that with some other time, right? Remember, something like this happens in the Schwarzschild solution. In Schwarzschild coordinates, at some point, a constant T hypersurface, T equals infinity actually, goes and coincides with R. But there, I can just change the time. I say, well, there is nothing special about Schwarzschild time, right? I take proper time, things work much better. Here, this is the time. And that essentially means that this surface, this R equal constant hypersurface, where this happens, acts as a universal horizon. Because on this surface, the ether is normal and pointing inwards. So the future is inwards. Everything that is to the future of the surface is actually inside. So there is no chance that anything that is inside there, no matter how fast it's propagating, can actually come outside again. So you get this weird thing that even if you add the high energy the higher order operators, even if you had the higher order terms, even if you modify the dispersion relations, unless you kind of manage to destroy the structure, then you will have a black hole This is not going to be a conventional black hole. The horizon is not going to be the horizon of any specific mode, but it's going to be this universal horizon. Why don't you expect to change this structure? You don't expect it because this horizon is sitting pretty close to the Schwarzschild horizon, to the black hole horizon, essentially, the standard black hole horizon, metric horizon, if you want, and very well separated from the singularity. I mean, it's sitting at a scale which has nothing to do with the Lorentz violating scale, has nothing to do with the scale where these operators are going to be important. So it seems to be a robust feature of these black holes when you have spherical symmetry. Now, and it seems that the concept of a black hole, therefore, persists with a very different meaning. Now, this result was found by us numerically. It was also found perturbatively by Diego Blass and Sergei Sibiryakov. They worked at the decoupling limit, essentially, and they tried to find the configuration of the ether or of the scalar on a Schwarzschild background, and they found again that it forms this horizon. So essentially, we have like an independent verification at the perturbative level, at the decoupling limit. But because essentially they had an analytic grasp of this, they could go one order, you know, they could also go and consider non-spherically symmetric perturbations to that. And what they find is that in Horava gravity, actually, this is an unstable, this seems to be an unstable horizon. It seems to be unstable against non-spherically symmetric perturbations. So then the question remains still unanswered. I mean, is this really a true horizon? It is not actually very clear because this all takes place at the level of the lowest order of the theory. So you're not sure what the operators, the higher order operators, will do either for the horizon or for the instability. But this, in my opinion, is a very interesting open question. Do we actually have black holes or not? What does that mean, the presence of this horizon? So let me conclude with this. So I'll just say that maybe I convinced you that Horava gravity is at least like a well-defined quantum gravity candidate. I mean, I've given you an action. This is the action. It can make some testable predictions. At least in some version of the theory, there is the major infrared viability consistency problems have been resolved. And it's not as easy as one might think to make progress because it is mostly unknown territory. I mean, violating Lorentz symmetry and playing with this stuff, you know, you have to give up a lot of your intuition. And I think we have managed to make some interesting predictions. There are things actually I didn't manage to mention at all. I didn't say anything regarding the cosmology of the theory. And there are interesting features there, like that it predicts a scale invariant power spectrum for cosmological perturbations without inflation, actually. And that is due to the anisotropic scaling in the UV. There is no horizon problem because modes propagating, high energy modes propagating infinitely fast and all that. There is also possible, there's some possible contact with strict quantum gravity candidates, and this has been discussed quite a bit lately. But most importantly, we have major challenges ahead. I mean, of course, there's the normalization, group flow, quantization, and the various other things I mentioned previously that are both difficult but also exciting because you could actually, for the first time, get some decent quantum gravity phenomenology out of this if you can overcome the technical difficulties. Maybe you could see some quantum predictions. So that's it. Thanks.
Have people looked at perfect fluids and things like that? Perfect symmetry?
Not really, no. No, not really. Nobody has really looked at the interior.
Stars.
Stars. In Horava gravity?
Well, it's not the same. Spherical symmetry is not the same as.
Are they? Don't you have to be in vacuum to have the same solution?
Then you have to be hypersurface or something. So it's not enough.
No, because there are two bits coming into this, right? I mean, there is, okay, of course, if you're in hypersurface orthogonality, the ether would be, sorry, if you're in spherical symmetry, the ether would be hypersurface orthogonal. But then remember, you're imposing this argument before you vary the field equations, which means that in the one case, when you vary and the ether is a vector that is hypersurface orthogonal, it is still a vector, fundamentally. So you get an equation of this sort for the ether. When it is, if you, What I mean is that if you have the ether and you impose at the level of the solution to be hypersurface orthogonal, you're still solving an equation of this sort for the ether, like a vector equals zero. Whereas if you had assumed before the variation that it's a gradient of a hypersurface orthogonal, it's a gradient of a scalar essentially, as you need for the equivalence, then you're solving a solution like this. Right? Because you get the extra derivative at the level of the variation. So you have to kind of argue that this implies that to have exactly the same solutions. And you can do that in vacuum, but I'm not sure you can do it if you have matter.
Well, but asymptotically, you can imagine that you have a star and you put boundary conditions asymptotically flat, then
so which one is, which one is
the first one. The ether equation is a vector equation.
Okay,
right?
So if you solve it in isolation, it's always a solution.
Yeah, but you're not sure if it's solved. If it's the only solution. Yeah, you don't know if it's a unique solution.
Which are solutions, I say, so they are solutions for our graph as well. Maybe they're not the whole set of solutions.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, maybe that's the point. Maybe they're not the whole set.
But doesn't the point that if this vanishes at infinity, then you are equivalent to the channel?
I'm not sure it's that trivial, because you also have to impose some regularity.
So. Regularity of the order. You expect both to be regular. It's a first order equation. Right?
It might be true. It might be true that you're just saying that. Is it? Because I mean, it might be that the exterior of the neutron star by itself is not regular anymore. I mean, the exterior of a star in general, if you try to analytically continue it inside the star, you move the matter analytically, it usually has singularities.
But this is for the you're talking about the ether, where the vector frame vector, right? So the vector should be. Then you expect it to be continuous.
Yeah, you might be right, actually. I don't know. Yeah. You might be right. That's because it's the vector, essentially, it doesn't couple to matter, so you don't really care. You can just say that it's continuous everywhere.
So I guess I had a comment about this eta parameter. So I guess the reason that this eta parameter was introduced, that for some reason, I guess it was claimed that there was no eta parameter, so the theory is not healthy, so it's non-projectable.
It's what I said about the projectable case. I mean,
I guess the thing, my point is that there is nothing unhealthy about the theory without eta in it. The non-projectable theory without eta. So it just, what happens is that the scalar doesn't have a kinetic term, it just have a gradient term. And so that's the same as the speed of sound going to infinity, which comes out of your equation. And all it says is that, okay, so if you don't have a dynamical scale, you shouldn't treat it as a quantum mechanical object. You should treat it like a Lagrangian multiplier as a constraint, which is not dynamical. And I don't see what's wrong with that. You don't have to have every single field to be dynamical in your scale.
Well, in the limit where eta goes to infinity, is exactly the limit I saw before.
Go to zero. No, infinity is the projectable version.
Oh, eta going to zero, you're saying?
Yeah.
No, eta going to zero is not a. I don't know if somebody claimed that eta going to zero is a bad limit.
But that was
eta going to zero. I agree with you. Eta going to zero is the limit where essentially you get infinite speed speed of sound for the. For the scalar mode, so you can. This is not unhealthy in any of the ways I described here, right?
But
there is another issue with that.
The cutoff goes to zero, doesn't it?
What happens? What goes to zero is a strong coupling scale.
It's strong coupling.
Yeah, this is what goes to zero.
But that's my point. That if eta is exactly zero, you have a dynamical field. So you don't. So you may naively think that it's a. Infinitely strongly coupled, but it's just not a dynamical theory. So it's like.
So what you're saying is I should treat it non-perturbatively, essentially. Yeah. Integrate out the scalar non-perturbatively.
Yeah,
and
but not as a quantum mechanical field, just a classical field.
No, that you can probably do. That you can probably do. But my only statement about that was that you cannot run to the Lorentz the Lorentz invariant point, which is both eta going to zero and lambda going to zero, going to one. That you cannot recover because the strong coupling scale will. Well, probably you can do it if eta is zero anyway. But yeah, but that would be a very exceptional case. So, and then you can also have to argue why the normalization group.
That's the argument that the eta equal to zero is different from a small eta, because in one case you have a dynamical field and the other you don't have a non-dynamical. So you're comparing a constraint with basically with the dynamical.
But can you keep eta to zero once you fix it to zero?
Well, so then you need to introduce a symmetry that makes it zero. But I mean, I argue that quantum corrections cannot make something that's not dynamical dynamical, because the name is corrections. But I have some arguments which are less more detailed. Than
okay, we can discuss in detail. Sure.
In this 2+1 dimensional case, did you at least check the scalar, the kinetic term?
Yeah.
Did it look like healthy at all?
As I said, the 2+1 case, if you do like perturbation, you look at the scalar mode at the propagator and all that, it's exactly the same qualitative. I mean, apart from the fact that you don't have the sixth order term, because you don't need them, you've stopped at fourth order. But apart from the sixth order term, qualitatively it's exactly the same. You just get the same couplings appearing at all the same places. Wherever you had something that depended on the dimension, instead of three, it's two essentially. But that's the only difference. And therefore, for the same, you don't have. It's easier to make it viable because since it's the single degree of freedom, you're not afraid that it's a ghost, right? You just change the overall sign. And it's always positive energy, but you make it stable essentially for classically stable for some region of the parameter space.
Well, maybe you cannot just change the overall sign because you want to have the potential bounded.
Sorry.
The two signs might be correlated. The sign of the kinetic term and the sign of the
So if you look at the general propagator, you have essentially like. The one thing is the relative sign, that is like the classical stability, and the other one is the absolute sign of the kinetic term, right? So I don't have now the problem of the absolute sign of the kinetic. If I have like a spin 2 graviton, a spin 0 graviton, if I ask the spin 2 graviton to be classically stable, then I get a sign in front of the kinetic term, and then I better have the same sign sitting in front of the other one. Here I don't have this problem. I just look at the relative sign and I can make it work.
Any other questions? So Thomas will be here till tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah.
And he's somewhere in the second floor towards the end.
2:21.
Okay. Let's thank you.